Bobbish.
Hi folks, thanks to be here for this talk about a gentle introduction to stream processing. I'm Nicolas Frankel. I've worked two decades in IT. For most of the time I worked in technical roles such as developers, and since 2 years I'm a developer advocate. I work for a company called Hazelcast. Hazelcast has two products. First is an in-memory data grid, and you can think about an in-memory data grid as data structures that are distributed along the network. So it's a distributed system with replication and sharding. The second is Hazelcast Jet, and I will need it for the demo, so I will describe it later on. This is our schedule for today. The first point that I want to talk about is why are we to the point where we use streaming, data streaming, stream processing. You might know it with several names, but it's becoming more and more ubiquitous. And there is a reason why we are at this point, and I need to describe it. Then I will tell you about two different streaming approaches. Then, as I mentioned, I will need to describe a bit Hazelcast Jet. And because streaming or data streaming is only as good as the data that you use, I will also have a point about open data. Like, open data is probably to data was open source is to source code, but I want to go a bit more into details there. Also, the demo is about showing public transportation on a map, and I need a standard for that, and so I will talk a bit about the general transit fit specification. And finally, I will try to run the demo, and of course, since it's a demo, there is a chance it won't work, but well, I rehearse a lot, and so it should. As I mentioned, I've been 2 decades in IT, and when I started working, data, they were all stored in SQL databases. And when we think about it, in some cases, those SQL databases are not really adapted to what we want to do. Like, for example, I have two use cases in mind. The first one is analytics. You're a supermarket sales director, and you want to have the sales of the previous hour. So you can say, hey, I didn't sell enough bananas or fishes. Oh, let's make a discount. So you want to have the results very, very fast. And probably you don't want to run any joins, or you just want, okay, what are the sales in each department? The other one is reporting. Probably when you want to have your annual account closing. Again, you don't want to run through all the year's operations to get the final result. You probably just want to have the result ready because you have like millions of customers, and it's going to take a long, long time if you need to run those operations. And so when I talk about those two use cases, there are already some like trade-offs involved. The first one is sometimes you want correct data. Like, yes, we want to have mathematical computation and we need to be very precise. But sometimes you just want to have fast data, like analytics. Whether your sales number is up by 0.1% or down by 0.1%, you don't care that much. It won't change the decision-making process. What is important is you get the data when you need it. And SQL is about being normalized. You probably have learned about normal forms and the first and second and third normal forms. And well, in analytics, in reporting, you don't care about the data being normalized. And because the data being normalized means it's stored in different tables, and you need to make joins And it's a penalty, it's a performance penalty. So what you prefer is, well, you don't care, you want fast data, so let's denormalize everything. And the fundamental tension is, in one case, we are interested in writes, like in normal SQL use cases, but in reporting, in analytics, we are only doing reads. And the use case for reads is completely different from the use case from writes. As I mentioned, that's the problem of SQL. I mean, SQL is very focused on correct data, on how you should write. So it's constraints and joins and normal forms. And yes, when we want performance, not that great. And so even at the time, 20 years ago, we had this need for an extract transform load pattern because we have different actors with different needs, and it didn't make any sense to use the same database. So what we did is we designed the batch model. And the batch model is all about extracting data from one database, transforming it, and probably it will mean to denormalize it and load it into a dedicated database that you only read from. I mean, you write from the batch, but users, they just read the data now. And well, if you have been working a bit in IT, batches, they are everywhere. I was a consultant for a long time, and well, in every customer I went to, like, they had batches. Like, they had, like, daily batches, weekly batches, but they had batches. And speaking about batches, yeah, batches, they have two interesting properties for us. They are scheduled. Most of the time, they are scheduled. So sometimes they run manually, but it's very rare. In general, hey, you run it every day or every week or every. And they take some time to run. And when you first develop your batch, you make sure that the time it runs in is lower than the scheduled frequency. So if you have a batch that runs every hour, you make sure that it runs under an hour. And probably you take a big margin buffer. Because what happens with time is your data will grow. And so the batch will probably take more time to run. And so there are some fun things that can happen after some time. Yes, you took a buffer, data will grow, and it will take more time. So even with this buffer, at some point, you will notice that you are getting close to the limit. So if your batch runs hourly, every hour, then you will like start sweating because every day you see that, hey, it takes 50 minutes, 51 minutes, 52 minutes. And yes, it happens sometimes. It goes over the limit. So when your new batch instance is scheduled to start, the old batch instance didn't finish. And that's not really, really fun. It also happens that, yes, when you are doing batching, you probably are loading everything in memory. And at some point, your data that is stored on disk is going to take a lot of place in memory, and even more so than you can handle. And getting back to the time it takes to run the batch, I was not mentioning that sometimes the batch may fail. So even if your batch takes half an hour for hourly batch, if you fail two times, you probably will have issues and the next batch will start before the old batch successfully finishes. So even when you have a big buffer, even if your data doesn't grow, even if everything is under control, batches, then they fail and bad stuff happens at the time. So there are a couple of solutions. Regarding the fact that it will take a long, a big place in memory, or that the batch may fail and we need to start from the beginning again, then we will probably need some chunks. So we will be keeping a cursor and we will be managing chunks of data. That's good, but then it creates a new question. So meanwhile, there is new data coming in. So we need to say, oh, this is in, this is out. We need to do some writing. Hey, we did handle this one. We didn't handle this one. I mean, it's Pandora's box if you go this way. And so the idea was we were limited for a long time because the SQL databases, they were not meant to scale horizontally. Remember 2 decades ago, you had enough computing power. If you didn't have enough computing power, you just put more RAM and you add or CPUs and you just had enough resources to handle that. And data was pretty limited. But with time passing, we had a lot of data to consume, to handle, and to transform. And it grows exponentially. And as you know, vertical scaling is limited and, is at best linear. So it didn't work. So this big data movement tried to handle that, saying, okay, now we will design tools that can scale horizontally. So it's just not adding more RAM and more CPUs, is adding more nodes. And that was the beginning of the NoSQL movement. By the way, if you think about the NoSQL movement, you must think about again, write versus read. Like, it's very easy when you are doing NoSQL to say, hey, we don't have no constraint, everything is fine, we just dumped data into the data store. Okay, that's fine, that's good. But then when you read the data, you need to know its form. With SQL, it's very easy. You have tables, you have constraints, you have PKs, and you have foreign keys. So you know the form of the data. With NoSQL, it's very hard. You need to look at each item. If we are in a document database, you need to understand each document to know what form it will have. And you infer that, yes, documents will mostly be similar to each other. So here I see a document that seems like customer, and perhaps the next document will be about customers too. But I mean, since there is no constraints on write, there is no schema on write, that means that when you process the data, you must create your own schema from the read, which again is an issue because it impacts performance. You need checks everywhere. And then came event-driven architecture. And in event-driven architecture, there is this word event. And basically, an event is just something that happens. That's even in UML, you have this kind of event and something happened. And now in computer system, what we are doing is we are reacting to this event. We are doing something with this event. So if you add more data to a database, this is an event. And so we can think about making everything event-based. And that's the basis for streaming. And the idea, it's very memory friendly because when you add data, it's small. It's might be self-contained or not, but it's pretty small. So it's memory friendly. You don't need to load everything into memory and terabytes. Because it's small, it's also easily processed. And there is an added benefit. It's the pull versus push model. Like when you are doing batches, you are explicitly pulling data from one place to another. When you've got streaming, data is pushed onto you. And so every time there is a change in data, you can do something. And this is not real time because there is no such thing as real time. Even light takes time to move from one place to another, but it is close to real time. And so the second benefit of that is that this derived data can be kept in sync with your source of truth. But we need to change our mindset, because before we were dealing with finite datasets, now we must deal with infinite datasets, because data can always come. Since I mentioned streaming, you might have heard the word about stateful streams. So of course, we all like stateless because it's easier to handle, but sometimes we need to keep some state. We just cannot handle the event, the data event, and do whatever we want and then continue. Like we sometimes want to do aggregation, like summing or averaging or whatever. And this must be done over a window of time. So I won't go into the details here, but remember that streams are not always stateless. Sometimes they must be stateful. And well, streaming is just ETL that is done smart. So instead of loading a chunk or everything and processing it and writing it, well, we do the same with small bits of data. And you can have many sources, just as in batches, and many different type of targets. But the idea is that in between, everything can be distributed. Again, we must handle a lot of data, so that means that we must scale horizontally. Scaling vertically is, well, it's possible, but it's very limited, and our workload is going to get bigger and bigger every day. And it opens lots of doors. Now, when we have streaming data, we can have real-time, again, not real-time, but close to real-time dashboards. I told you about the supermarket director who haunted the stats of the latest hour. Now, think about this. We want the stats of the last hour. When do we run the batch? Do we run the batch when the hour is finished, meaning that it will take some time to run the batch and we will have the data after? Might take 2 minutes, 1 minute, but it won't be when we want the data. Or if we can infer the time it takes to run the batch, we need to run the batch a bit before, but then we won't have the complete data. But again, it's not an issue. Having the complete data, like if we just compute everything from the 59 minutes, the first 59 minutes in an hour, we still will have a good enough understanding that we can take our decisions to make some discounts on such products. Because the fact that we are slicing time by hour is very artificial. Time runs continuously. It's only because our understanding of time is limited that we must say, okay, I want to have the stats in the last hour. Now imagine that instead of having the stats in the last hour, we have always the statistics that are coming to us. So perhaps at half the hour, we already have some understanding of what happened. We can make decisions. And this is for a human mind, but imagine that we couple this streaming data to some machine learning model, we can probably make predictions. And this is going to be more and more the case in the future. Also, if you have been working in IT for a couple of years, you might have come upon the term complex event processing. Complex event processing was pretty hype when we were doing enterprise service buses in the enterprise. And this was the idea that every software would like publish events into the ESB, and then other pieces of software would like subscribe to them and then handle them. The idea was, if different pieces of software publish different events, then one of them could like infer something complex that, hey, this sensor sent, I don't know, like a rise in temperature. This other sensor sent events, and you inferred a rise in humidity, and well, whatever. And yes, it didn't work that well, and the ESB today is pretty much, I don't know, gone probably. But now with data streaming, you can do the exact same stuff. You can do complex event processing. So different data streams, different data events coming from different sources, and you can make something out of it. Regarding approach, when we talk about events, you probably heard a lot about Kafka. And just something to remember, Kafka is about storing events. But there is also something called Apache Pulsar. I won't go into the depths of it. Just know that Kafka is not the only event storing system out there. Regarding Kafka, well, it has some interesting properties. The first is distributed by nature. It's distributed. Again, we want everything to be horizontally scalable, and storage is among one of the things we want to be distributed. It stores on disk, which in some cases is a good thing. In some other cases might not be a good thing. Meaning that if we need to handle data, we don't want to store data and transform data and restore data on disk. Perhaps we just want to get from something in memory to something in memory. In that case, storing on disk might not be such a good idea. But sometimes we want to store on disk. In that case, Kafka is very good. And events, they are stored on a topic. And the good thing is that like producer and consumer are decoupled in such a way that the consumer keep track of the offset of the message in the topic that it last read, so that you can have a very, very fast producer that writes on the topic and a slow consumer, and the consumer will consume data at its own pace. Even more, you can have consumers with a difference that are reading at different speeds, and they all work very well together. And as I mentioned, you don't always want to write on disk. Sometimes you want to handle data in memory. And in that case, you have stream processing engines. So there are different types of them. Some of them are installed on-premise, for example, Apache Flink or Hazelcast Jet. Some are cloud-based, Kinesis, Dataflow. And I need to mention Apache Beam. Apache Beam is an interesting Apache project, in my opinion. It tries to be an abstraction over a stream processing engine. So there is this API, and then you can more or less like change the implementation, changing Flink for Jet, for example, or something like that. I think it's a good initiative, of course, since there is no such standard. So all stream processing engine, they work more or less the same, but there is no standard. And so it's an abstraction that is a bit leaky, of course. But still, I believe it's interesting to have a look at it. Hazelcast Jet. First, it's open source project. So everything that I will show you is open source. We are using in-memory data grid underneath to store storm state. And the good thing about the API is that you can start from batching, because streaming, again, you need to change your mindset. So you can start from batching and then change one line of code, and then you've got streaming. And it's pretty good. All stream processing engines basically are built on those two building blocks, but here I will use the semantics of JETS. Some others might have different semantics, but you will easily match them. So on the left side, we have the pipeline, and the pipeline is the code that you write. It's a declarative pipeline where you say, hey, I will read from this source, I will do this step of transformation, this other step of transformation, blah, blah, blah. And then I will write there. Once you have written your code, you can send it to the stream processing engine. Now the stream processing engine receives the pipeline, and it's its job to execute it on the cluster. It has several nodes, and it's up to the stream processing engine to say, okay, I will transform it into a job and send it to different nodes. And it will do the routing, it will do the control, it will do everything. JET has two deployment modes. The first one, if you are a Java developer or a JVM developer, let's say, it's the easiest one. It's just a library you add it to your class path, and now every time you start your application, you can start also a JET node. They will multicast. They will try to auto discover themselves. Then they will form a cluster, and this is good, but it is quite limited. In that the problem is now you cannot scale horizontally your application from your JET cluster. So you are bound by the lowest performance hit on each of them. And also, if you know about the JVM, you know that probably you need to configure it to have the best performance. And in that case, again, you need either to configure the JVM to be more performant regarding your application, or more performant regarding the cluster. In general, what you do very soon is you move to the client server mode, where you have a JET cluster and you have your application. And your application now is just a client of the cluster. And now you can scale them independently, you can configure them independently. And as an added benefit, you don't need to use Java on the client side. So we have an API for Python, an API for C Sharp, an API for Node.js, an API for Go, and for C and C++. So it gives you a lot more freedom. Here is just a bird's eye view of JET. We have default readers, we have default writers, and in the middle, as I mentioned, you can do all the transform and whatever. Something that is worth mentioning is that if there is no reader or no writer that is adapted to your use case, there is an API to write your own. So in the demo, I will show you how you can read from a web service, for example. And also something that is very important is enrichment. As I mentioned, the events that are handled through the pipeline, they are small, they might be self-contained. And in general, on the writer side, on the right side, you want your events to have all the data. You don't want to need to go to another SQL database, for example. This is also true for the pipeline. You don't want every time you need to enrich to add more data. So you have, for example, you have a sensor and you have the sensor ID and you have all your sensors in your SQL database. If every time you need to look to the SQL database to get all data from the sensor and to put the full-fledged sensor data into your event, it will be a performance hit. So the idea is, in general, what you do, and that's what I'm doing in the demo, you load everything into memory first, for example, in IMDG. And then, since everything is in memory in JET, and since everything is in memory in IMDG, well, there is a chance that they are on the same node. That's very easy. Then you just get it from the memory. If it's in another node, perhaps data has been replicated. Otherwise, it's just a round trip over the network. So it's much faster than reading from the disk. Now that we have defined data streaming, we need some data to work on. And as I mentioned in my introduction, open data is to data what open source was to software before. And whereas open source is pretty settled right now, open data is much more confidential because I believe data part of things was also much more confidential than source code. Since I live in France and I work in Switzerland, I like reference the stuff from France and Switzerland. Also, European Union has some big open data initiatives. So the idea is those state, those public organizations, they try to make data, as much data available to people so that they can like benefit society. But there are open data initiatives also in California, and depending where you are from, there will probably some kind of open data initiative in your region. But once you get data, you will notice that there are some challenges. It's not a free lunch. So I will talk about how you access the data, what's the format of the data, is there any standards, and the correctness of the data. As developers, I would assume that you access data indirectly through a web service. That's very, very wrong. Most public administrations, they let you have open data and you need to download the data from a file, which defeats the purpose of having data streaming, because now you need to schedule a batch that downloads the file and whatever. Regarding the formats, you might also infer that open data means open format. So you would think about text or perhaps XML or even JSON. Well, let me tell you that a lot of open data is through Excel files, and not even the new Excel files, which is just a zip with multiple XML files in it. No, I'm telling you about the old Excel format, which is binary and completely proprietary, which is a bit funny. When I'm using data, again, I don't want to infer the format of the data. I would like to have a structure. I want to have schema on write, not schema on read. And XML was super good. So imagine that we are using XML. Well, what's the grammar? I mean, is it SVG? Is it MathML? What is it? And I would like to have this standard that is congruent to a domain. If I'm doing public transportation, I want to have the grammar for public transportation. Well, let's say that in general, again, there are some good exceptions, but in general, it's up to you to infer the formats of the data. Or if you are lucky, then perhaps there is like 100 page of documentation and you need to browse through them and to understand what's the form. Data correctness, that's the final nail in the coffin, is that you might have heard data scientists complaining that, yeah, they are not doing really data science, like 80% of their time is they are trying to clean up the data. And here you can see it from the demo. Here I have a time, and I know what 16:20 is. I have a hard time understanding what 25:00 is. Is it invalid data? Is it 1:00 a.m. the next day? What should I do? And again, I have no clue. So that's the kind of stuff that you are confronted with when you use open data. And here I have, I need to talk about some standards. There is this stuff in public transportation called GTFS. And GTFS stands for General Transit Fit Specification. And it allows you to give data in an expected format. So you have two kinds of data. The first one is data that changes rarely. For example, the stops. the stops, probably the bus stop, the train stop, the train station, they rarely move around. So it stands to reason that you download them beforehand, or perhaps every week or every month, I don't know, and then you keep them here. And the second set of data is the dynamic data, for example, the position, which actually is streaming data, because when the public transport, the train moves, for example, it will sense its position. And yes, this is actually the streaming data as it is. Here, for references, you have all the files of the static model, and you can see there are a lot. Some of them are required, some of them are optional. And here you have the dynamic model. it's quite complicated. So here, this is the route message. You have a feed message, and then you have in this feed message, which is the outer envelope, you have many feed entities, and each feed entity might have a vehicle position, and that's what we are interested in. And I've already done this talk before, especially the demo. And before, I used a Swiss provider. Unfortunately, the Swiss provider changed its data access a lot, so that I cannot do streaming anymore. So now I'm using a California provider, but I kept the same pipeline, which is the following. I will read from a web service, so that's good. I'm using a web service, and I will split this feed message that you saw, the envelope, into the different feed entity. And then every time I will do some enrichment from the static files that I've previously downloaded, and I will put everything into an Hazelcast IMDG map. And this gives me the following architecture. Here I have a jet cluster that runs. And well, I have a single node because I run it on my machine, but you can like scale it however you want. And at first, like before actually streaming, I will launch a job that actually will read from those downloaded files and like read them, transform them into some form of JSON, and store the JSON into IMDG. Then when that is done, I have another job that I send to the cluster, and this job will call the REST endpoint, the open data endpoint, and again, do the pipeline that I referenced in the previous slides and store the JSON in IMDG as well. And then I have a third component. This component reads from changes in IMDG and will like get the data, and on the front end, I will be able to display the position of the buses in real time. So now it's time for me to show you the code. So here is the project. I have the first module. This is Kotlin. I'm using a Maven, of course, I believe this is pretty readable. So here you have this load static module that reads from the files. And then I have the stream dynamic that models the pipeline to read from the web service. And here we can have our main stuff. And here I told you about the pipeline, and I believe it's pretty readable. I will read from the service. I will flat map, so I will explode the envelope, and I will get it to feed entities. Then I will map each of them to JSON. Sometimes I want to filter out data that I don't want, that's some data that is fishy, so I will remove entities that are without trips or entities that are without stops. Then, as I mentioned, I will do some enrichment. So I will adds to this entity the stop time, the trips, and the routes. And here I can do the same with the stops. So here the map using IMAP is I'm getting the ID from something that is already stored in the map. Here I need to do some more additional transformation. So I have another API for that. I will write it down in the log because I just want to make sure. And I will transform this JSON to an entry, meaning I will need to have an ID and to have a value, and I will store that in the remote map. And then I have this web application that reads from this remote map and put everything into a WebSocket. So let's first start JET. I'm running inside my IDE, but if you want to do that demo at home, there are instructions on how you can do it without the IDE. Here it's just much easier for me to do that. And let's load the static data. For this purpose of demonstration, I only have one single agency, meaning I won't have a lot of data, so it runs pretty fast. And yes, probably it's already finished now. So as you can see, doesn't take too long. And now I can stream the data. So there, when I'm streaming the data, I will make the call to the web service. And again, as I mentioned, like do some lot of transformation and store everything into NDG again. And now it's time for me to like start the web application. Yes. And now I will open a browser. And you can see that I already have the routes that are displayed, and I have the buses. And you can see the buses, they are moving. So the idea here is that I receive data every 8 seconds. So I am interpolating because I receive the schedule. So when I receive the schedule, I receive also position of the vehicle. I set it on the map, and when I receive the schedule, it tells me, hey, it should be there at this time, at the next stop. So I'm interpolating. And when I receive the new data, well, perhaps the interpolation was wrong. So I need to put it perhaps a bit backward, a bit forward. So that's sometimes why you see this like teleportation of the buses going backward and forward. Like here, for example, it happened. So it's just that, yes, it's not like the exact position. If we wanted to have the exact position, we could just have snapshots, and that's not what we want. We want to have like a smoothly moving vehicles. So when I receive new data, I need to say, oh, interpolation. Okay, I need to check whether it was right or wrong. If it was wrong, then I need to put the transport in its correct location. And obviously, this provider is mainly located on the eastern side of San Francisco. So, recap of this talk. Streaming has a lot of benefits. You can leverage available data. So, it can be the data of your company. But if you don't have such data or you don't have enough, you can also leverage open data. And it's really, really good. You can do a lot of cool stuff. So thanks for your attention. You can read my blog. You can follow me on Twitter. If you want to know more about JET, we have a site for that. If you want to get the codes, if you want more detail, you can look at the codes. I try to be very explicit in the codes. And if I got you interested in JET, please join our Slack. So thanks a lot. And